yourself a song to sing and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Okay, today we're going to turn back to the economy theme. And the topic here is what I will call the emerging global perfect storm. Okay, what that implies is that on the horizon at the beginning here, we may see a convergence of some very serious economic developments that may lead us to another financial crisis. Okay, what am I talking about? I'm talking about three things. One, the trend of China's economy slowing long term and problems beginning to emerge in the Chinese economy. I'm talking about the drift towards deflation in the Eurozone. Notwithstanding what you hear about European recovery, if you call 0.3% GDP growth a recovery, I don't. I call that a manipulated stagnation. The drift towards deflation in the Eurozone, meaning the real economy is slowing, even though their GDP numbers may be stagnant. And then thirdly, most importantly, a crisis in emerging markets. They call them markets, but they're really national economies. We're talking about India, Brazil, Indonesia, Turkey, South Africa, Chile, Mexico, countries like that. Emerging markets. In other words, they're sort of growing. They're not at the pace of China, but they were coming on fast. Now they are in reverse. So emerging markets, Eurozone, and China. And now most recently, too, we'll talk about this. It looks like this vaulted, heralded recovery in Japan is also slowing now. Okay, so the question is, are these three areas constitute a perfect storm, economic, global perfect storm? You know, a perfect storm. You ever see that movie with George Clooney? Pretty good show. If you've ever been to see, it would scare you because you really know how terrible a perfect storm is and how dangerous the sea is. But perfect storm is the convergence of three storm fronts. And what I'm talking about is three economic storm fronts. Slowing China, rapidly retracting, contracting emerging markets, and a stagnant Europe. Are they converging? What are the contagions between these three perfect storms? Or three storms that constitute a perfect storm. What are the contagion effects between all three? Are there mutually amplifying economic effects, feedbacks, in other words, that will make all three worse? By the way, I have an article coming out here in about another week, March issue of Z Magazine, on that very same topic. So if you want to read even more detail, more data than we'll talk about here, get yourself a copy of Z Magazine. After that, I will also have the article on my website, Kyklos Productions, kyklosproductions.com, or you can blog me, jackrasmus.com, and get to my website from there. Okay, let's talk about this emerging perfect storm. Two of the three storm fronts, of course, are offshore, emerging markets in China. Of course, Europe is offshore, but it's concentrated elsewhere in the world, whereas what we've had here up until the recent is the concentration of the global crisis in North America and Europe, among the developed economies. We are entering the third phase of the global economic crisis. We are at a transition, a juncture to that third phase. What were the other two phases? Well, the first phase is roughly the time period early 2008 and early 2008 to, let's say, mid-2009. Mid-2009 would be about the right time. Okay. The second phase, when is the second phase? The second phase would be from, let's say 2010 to about 2012. Maybe a little bit bleeding into 2013. Okay. Either one. The third phase, of course, is just emerging now in late 2013, early 2014. So we got three phases. Two have been complete, and the third coming now. And what this means is that the global crisis is shifting around. It hasn't ended. The U.S., through various means and policies, has exported it elsewhere, both in the second phase, and now it's being exported again. Second phase, crisis was pushed to Europe. Third phase is being pushed to the emerging markets. It's been 5 years. 5 years. In fact, this month is the anniversary, if you think about it, of Obama's first stimulus program, passed in February 2009. Remember that? 5 years ago. That was a spending and tax cut program of $787 billion. Yeah, they added another $20, $30 billion later in the year with cash for clunkers, rebate program, and first-time homebuyers rebate program, so about $800 billion. That got us a little bit of a recovery in the second half of 2009, but it dissipated, and by the summer of 2010, the U.S. economy was flat on its back. That was followed in 2010, late 2010, with another $857 billion stimulus. Virtually all tax cuts, primarily for business, and $55 billion for unemployment insurance extension. So we have about a trillion and a half of fiscal stimulus, mostly tax cuts, in 2009-10. And they didn't really jumpstart the economy. We kept going thereafter in a stop-go kind of scenario. In fact, in the beginning of 2011, we had what probably was a double-dip recession. The economy stopped growing in first quarter and barely grew in the second quarter. So at best, it was stagnant in that first half of 2011. But that's only because we use a very conservative inflation deflator index. You know, we're talking about real GDP, and real GDP is what's called, what's left over after you have nominal GDP, in other words, economic growth with price inflation, and then you take out the price inflation, you adjust that, and you get real GDP. That's the number you hear. Well, if you underestimate the inflation, you're going to overestimate real GDP. And that's what the GDP deflator index does. It underestimates inflation purposely so that we get an overestimated real GDP number, growth number. Well, in the first half of 2011, you know, even with the GDP deflator, we get a stagnant economy. If we had used the consumer price index, we would have gotten a double dip. And we have another similar event occurs in the fourth quarter of 2012, right? We had a stagnant economy, and it would have been negative. In fact, it initially was negative, and they readjusted it barely, positive, a couple tenths of 1%. So anyway, it's arguable that we here in the U.S. had at least a double dip. arguable. Well, I'm not going to press that point. Stagnation is adequate evidence of lack of real recovery, just as a double dip would be even more evidence. Right. Well, you know, the problem was that this stimulus bill, of one, two versions here, first and second Obama stimulus, about $1.6 trillion, was poorly composed. In other words, it was mostly tax cuts, mostly for the rich, and subsidies for the states that got passed through it on unemployment insurance and so forth. Well, you don't create jobs that way, either with business tax cuts, which got hoarded, and subsidies to the states, which also got hoarded by the states. You know, there was a lot of talk about this would generate 6 million jobs. Well, we lost 1.5 million jobs in 18 months following the introduction of this Obama stimulus. And then Obama had to change his message and say, minimized job loss. In other words, there would have been more jobs lost. That's because the states, you know, were supposed to hire with that money. They didn't. Maybe they didn't lay off as many. That was the argument, you see. So that whole fiscal stimulus was poorly composed. In other words, too much tax cuts for businesses and subsidies don't create jobs. It was also insufficient in terms of its size, its magnitude. Now, the first one, $787 billion, even in Congress, wanted to spend $1.1 trillion. And various economists were saying we need to spend at least $1.5 trillion. I was saying we needed to spend $2.2 trillion at the time. So $787 billion, even Congress wanted $1.1 billion. Obama listened to his advisor, Larry Summers, and said, no, we can't spend more than $800 billion. So Summers is the guy who made sure the spending was insufficient, apart from the fact that it was poorly composed. You know, and if you compare our $787 billion, what was that? That was about 5% of GDP, that whole package. Compare that with the Chinese at the time when the global crash occurred and all the economies in the world went down. What did the Chinese do? They spent 15% of GDP, and it wasn't in tax cuts or subsidies. It was government direct investment in infrastructure and other business job-creating projects. Not 1 point, but 15% was a hell of a lot more than 5%. And their recovery was rapid, V-shaped recovery. The Obama program was also poorly timed. In other words, to the extent there was spending on infrastructure, about $100 billion, it was stretched over 10 years. So you get a minuscule $10 billion infrastructure boost out of that initial Obama program. By the way, you can read that in my book, Obama's Economy Recovered for a Few, published in 2012, where I document that in great detail and make that argument. And that's pretty much why we didn't get a sharp recovery. Too much taxes, too much subsidies, no real job program, no real housing program, very little infrastructure. You know, they used to talk about, this is going to be shovel-ready government spending projects. Yeah, well, they couldn't find the shovels, I guess. Okay, so not too long after that minuscule, inadequate $1.6 trillion poorly composed, timed, insufficient magnitude fiscal bill, we started taking it away immediately in 2011. Right? Remember that? The August 2011 debt ceiling deal? They took out $1 trillion of that $1.6 trillion. And they've earmarked another $1.2 trillion in the sequester. Of course, they backload that after the elections. You know, these politicians aren't stupid. They never really cut during an election year, just like this one. They always cut in the off years. So that's $2.2 trillion taken back after they put $1.6 trillion in. And remember the fiscal cliff? Yes, the fiscal cliff. That was another $4 trillion over the decade in, again, Bush tax cuts extensions. They they took $600 billion out of the $4.6 trillion of Bush tax cuts and left $4 trillion in. All they had to do was let those Bush tax cuts expire, and there would be no deficit problem at all anymore. But they extended it because 80% of it went to the rich and the corporations. And then we had this sequester revisiting here a couple months ago. Remember the government shutdown and all that nonsense? Yeah, well, that was a whopping $68 billion deal, short-term deal. I mean, that's pittance. And they claimed they were putting $68 billion back into the economy. Now we wouldn't have to cut defense. Now we put $31 billion back in general spending cuts under the sequester. It's a two-year deal, you know. I mean, the 8 years of that sequester still lurks out there come 2016. Okay, but, you know, they say they put $68 billion back, but look, they just cut $25 billion unemployment insurance extension. They cut $16 billion in food stamps. They cut another $26 billion in vets, pensions, and government workers and raised fees on travel. Well, that's $67 billion. So they take with, give back with one hand and they take with the other. No net effect on the economy. So all in all, if you look at U.S. fiscal policy, spending and tax cuts, what have we done? Well, we put in $1.6 trillion, and we take out $2 trillion. And in the meantime, we pass another $4 trillion in Bush tax cuts. Well, that's the whole picture. Well, no wonder there's no real stimulus there. It's all smoke and mirrors. Unlike China, 15% of GDP. Right? China also stimulated its monetary policy directly. And I'll talk about the Fed monetary policy. I'm getting to the third phase in the emerging perfect storm. Don't worry, I'm getting there. But we got to get a picture of the U.S. in the first phase, right? Now, what did we get for it in the U.S.? Oh, we got a measly 1.8% GDP average over the last 5 years, one half of normal recoveries. And we got those two relapses or double dips. Oh, but wait a minute, we got a surge in the economy in the second half of last year, right? Over 3% growth in the third quarter and 2%, which is now being revised down, by the way, in the fourth quarter. Well, I wrote an article last early November looking at the third quarter GDP and, you know, the 200,000 per month job creation claims, and I said these are false positives and that we're going to see a slowing once again of job creation and the economy at the end of the fourth quarter and in early 2014. And lo and behold, isn't that what's happening? Yes. 74,000 jobs only created in December, 113 in January. And as I predicted, the economy was going to slow. The growth in the economy was going to slow again. Longer term, what did we get for all of this? You know, fiscal spending and tax cuts. What did we get for all of this? Well, not much. We got 5 million jobs, but 5 million people left the labor force, too. The jobs that were created, 58% were low paid. 60% of the jobs lost were high paid. Median family household income has been declining every year. People have been spending based on debt and credit. In fact, we just had an indicator yesterday about household credit and debt is almost back where it was in 2007. Yeah, people are spending, but not because they got income, because they got credit. And they're being lured with credit cards again, and they're being lured by auto discounts again, and they're being lured by big discounts by retailers during the holidays because people can't buy based on income. Over the last 5 years, the wealthiest 1% households have gotten 95% of all the income increase. Oh, yes, let me repeat that. The 1% got 95% of the recovery in income, measured in income. How do you like that for a recovery? Well, if you're in the 1%, I guess you do. consumer spending is up, especially for the wealthiest 10%, who make their money from stocks and other capital incomes. The rest of us, to the extent we spend, it's based on loading up with credit again. Stock market increased 150% over the last 5 years, from 6,500 to over 16,000. Corporations are hoarding $2 trillion in cash. Multinationals, 1.7, and offshore subsidiaries. By the way, I wrote an article about the great corporate tax shift in the December issue of Z Magazine. That's on my website, too, if you're interested. Banks have excess reserves, cash, in other words, of $1 trillion is sitting on. And corporations in general are engaging in record stock buybacks and dividend payouts. Well, that's why they extended the Bush tax cuts, which were very, very generous, to dividends and capital gains. They knew these buybacks and dividend payouts were coming, and they wanted to extend it, and they succeeded in that. And as far as the banks being bailed out, forget this $2 trillion passage of tax cuts and corporate spending in the last 5 years for businesses and investors. That's about $2 trillion. The banks got bailed out to the tune of $14 trillion. Yes, $14 trillion. Congress didn't bail out the banks. The Federal Reserve bailed out the banks. With $14 trillion, $4 trillion in quantitative easing. In other words, print some money and go buy the subprime, bad subprime bonds from wealthy investors as well as institutions and banks. That's a direct subsidy. And then $10 trillion in special auctions and near zero interest loans provided by the Federal Reserve. You know, if you're a bank, you can go to the Federal Reserve. And as a result of the Federal Reserve, go to another bank and borrow at 1/10 to 0.75%. 1/10 of 1%, you can borrow money if you're a bank. And then what do you do with that money? Well, you don't loan it to mom-and-pop business to create jobs. You know, what you do with the money is you loan it to hedge funds who give you 5, 6% and then take the money offshore and invest offshore. Or you invest offshore as a bank. Oh, you remember J.P. Morgan Chase and its London Whale? Well, offshore investing, speculating. In financial markets, you know, the money, this $14 trillion, hasn't gone into the U.S., very little of it. It's gone offshore, some of it into real investment in emerging markets, China, Brazil, Indonesia, India, South Africa, Australia, blah, 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 right? Some of it. Creating jobs over there. But most of it has gone into financial markets, both in the U.S. and globally. Stock markets, junk bond markets, foreign exchange markets, emerging market funds, real estate in Asia, speculating in U.S. land farm prices, government bonds, speculation in Europe, derivatives of all kinds. That's where all this money has gone. It's flowed offshore. It's flowed in financial markets. It doesn't create any jobs here. Now, getting closer to our arguments of this third phase of the global crisis and the perfect storm. A lot of this money, as I just said, went offshore. Where did it go? A lot of it went investment in China by multinational corporations. A lot of it went into emerging markets. No, in other words, you know, the Brazils, the Indias, Indonesia's, Turkey, South Africa's, etc., etc. Now, because China was booming, China needs a lot of resources and commodities and intermediate goods. And China is part of this trade thing called the BRICS, B-R-I-C-S, you know, which stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and other countries like Australia. Not part of the BRICS, but Australia, minerals and natural resources demand has exploded as China grew, and it dragged China growth, record China growth. Remember, 15% of GDP, China has a decline, like the whole world declined in 2009, But China snaps right back with growth because of its direct government investment and because they didn't have shadow banks that were sucking the money out and speculating with it. So China has a V-shaped recovery, and it pulls up the emerging markets with it. At the same time, and this is important, at the same time, all this money capital from the Fed, its QE, its zero interest rates, and similarly for the Bank of England and the Bank of Japan to some extent, European Central Bank to some extent, all this money flows out of the West, out of the developed countries, flows into emerging markets in China. Because that's where the growth is. That's where the speculation is best. That's where they can make biggest profits. So global investors, you know, who keep their money in these couple dozen tax havens around the world, including corporate investors, you know, Bahamas and Cayman Islands and Liechtenstein and Isle of Man and the Seychelles and Vanuatu. Yeah, you probably didn't even heard of those. Well, these are all little tax havens around the world, which rich folks, the ultra high net worth individuals, keep their money in those places. There's about 200,000 of them across the globe. 200,000 very, very wealthy investors who make 30 million plus a year in income additions. I'm not talking about assets, I'm talking about income additions. 30 million to 100 million. 30 million is kind of a cutoff point. 100 million, you know, if you don't make 100 million a year, you're not in the 200,000. About 70,000 of them in the U.S., and about 50,000, 50, 60,000 in Europe, the rest in Asia and places. You know, these are very high net worth, ultra high net worth individuals. These folks don't invest in job-creating businesses and mom-and-pop and wait for 10 years to get their return. They speculate in these financial markets, in these fast turnover, matter of months, weeks sometime, derivatives and real estate, foreign exchange, junk bonds, stock markets. They move their money around quickly. Jump in, jump out, make a killing. Drive the price up, jump out. Okay. So all this money from the West flows into the emerging markets in China as a result of the monetary policies of the Fed since 2008, actually, and the other central banks to a lesser extent. At the same time, China recovers, and the real economy drives up the real economy in the emerging markets. And then all this money flows in and stimulates and drives it up even further, and all the speculation occurs on top of it. And emerging markets boom, while the money flowing out of the West does not go to real recovery, especially in Europe. They have, for certain reasons, they are weaker structurally, economically. They really don't have a central bank compared to the U.S. But it flows out because that's where the profits are, and the capitalists take their money where the profits are. A nice growth convergence for emerging markets and China. And that's why we have stagnation at best in the West, or had, because now that is all changing. It is all reversing. And now the money is flowing back. The money capital is flowing back in huge amounts, flowing out of the emerging markets, particularly the Fragile Five, as they now call them, India, Brazil, Indonesia, Turkey, South Africa, who are basket cases and going to get worse. The money's flowing out of there and flowing back to the West or back into China. Now, a lot of emerging markets in China are putting them, I mean, in Asia, are putting their money in China. Inflows, capital inflows in 2012, China were like 10, 20 billion. Now, last year, 250 billion. Okay, so the money is flowing back to safety and to the new growth, the capitalists who dominate in the West. Remember, 200,000 of them, 140,000 are European and North American, another couple tens of thousands, you know, Japanese. These are the finance capitalists who are running the show. Okay. So that's the scenario. That's why we are entering a third phase now. And in that third phase, the money is flowing back. In that third phase, China is also simultaneously slowing down, which means the emerging markets slow down even more. Okay, so why are emerging markets slowing down? Because the Fed and the central banks in the West have changed their policies. And as a result, the money is flowing back to the West. At the same time, China, for other reasons, is slowing down as well. So it's a double whammy on the emerging markets. And a big contraction, and the question unknown is, what will be the contagion of the emerging market contraction, both on the West and on China? And then, why is China also slowing down for other reasons? It's not because the money's flowing out of China like it is out of emerging markets. In fact, flowing from the emerging markets into China as well as to the U.S. and Europe. So why is China slowing down? Okay, we're going to take a break, and we come back, we're going to answer that question and talk more about this growing potential for a global economic perfect storm and phase three emerging of the global economic crisis. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. We'll be back shortly.
Now sometimes tomorrow comes soaked in treasure and blood. Here we stood the job, now we'll stand the flood. There's a new world coming, I can see the light. I'm a jack of all trades, we'll be all right.
This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, and we're talking about the potential emerging global perfect storm and the phase three of the global economic crisis, which may be just emerging. Okay. We left the discussion before the break saying that China now is slowing. China was growing at 12-14% before the crisis. It, too, as the rest of the world, had a sharp contraction as a result of the 2008-09 global economic crisis. But as I said before, China immediately recovered because it had a true fiscal stimulus driven by government investment, job creating in nature, construction, manufacturing, and so forth, and a monetary stimulus to correspond to the increased fiscal stimulus. Okay, and China recovered with a sharp V-shaped recovery, snapped right back. As it snapped back, it pulled up the emerging markets because China has a great demand for resources and raw materials and intermediate goods from these emerging markets. At the same time, the emerging markets and China got a second boost by all this money capital flowing in from the West. Okay. China's recovery was significant up until about 2012. In 2012, signs of China were beginning to slow down, slowly slowing down. Not a contraction, you know, but the growth itself was slowing down. You know, less than around 7.5 to 8% instead of 12-14%. There is some dispute whether it's even that high, because of the way China gathers its data, economic data. And you know, a number of realistic arguments have been made that China's growth is really 1 to 1.5% less than that. So we're really talking about somewhere between 6 and 7.5%. Significant. Significant. Right? China's economy now is almost $10 trillion. The U.S. is 17. The composition of its growth is far more healthy in terms of manufacturing and construction and so forth, rather than low-paid service jobs like the U.S. But anyway, as China grew, around 2011, 2012, continuing to grow, it opened up its economy to Western capital even further, Western banks. One of the conditions, you know, the U.S. and China meet every year in Beijing, top economic people in governments, and they sort of agree where they're going to agree. And one of the demands that had been always strongly proposed by the U.S. Delegation is you got to open up your banking system. In other words, we want our big banks to have a toehold here in China. And China, slowly and step by step, has opened up its banking system. But that's its official banking system. Then there's the unofficial banking system, what we call shadow banks. You know, hedge funds, private equity firms, so on and so forth. And they piled into China after 2011-12. And there is now a shadow banking problem in China. When we say shadow banks, think about speculation, because that's really what these guys are about, shadow banks. They're all about making big profits through price appreciation. So they want to see prices driven up, and they act to drive them up. And guess what? By 2011-12, we start getting a housing bubble in China. Residential housing and commercial building, local government debt bubbles begin to grow significantly by 2013. Prices, home prices, housing prices rising 20% instead of 3 to 5% previously. So a lot of money being made in China by international speculators, loaning money directly to local governments for local government projects and for housing projects and for residential and apartment buildings and so forth. Okay, creating bubbles in the construction sector of the economy there, just like it happened here in 2004, 5, 6, 7. Same thing. Very similar thing. Driven by the same shadow bank sector. Now, remember, the shadow banks is where these ultra-high net worth individuals, investors, $300 million a year income to spend, put a lot of their money. So property prices really explode in China. Debt explodes because that's what finances a lot of this. And we get a rising debt problem in China. Private debt. I'm not talking about government debt. I'm talking about private sector debt. I'm not talking about household debt, but private business, financial, non-financial business, centered on the local construction, housing, commercial property, other projects. I won't give you the statistics for this, but you can read it, the data in on my blog, in an article that will soon be posted, and next week the article that comes out on the emerging storm in Z Magazine. Okay, so China has, by 2012-13, begins to develop this bubble and this problem in the financial sector. Also around 2012, it starts to slow. Now, it's not initially because of the bubble. It's because China is trying to make a transition to a more consumption-based, consumer-based economy. You know, in the U.S., 70% of GDP is consumers, consumer spending. In China, 35%. And conversely, real investment by the private sector is 9-10%. In China, it's 45%. That's why China is growing so fast and steadily, because it's this huge amount of investment driven by government policies. Totally contrary to what we do here. Okay, so we have this scenario of China trying to correct and to transition to a more consumption-based economy. To do that, China has to slow down its investment spending and somehow put more money in the hands of consumers and speed up its consumption spending. And it's been testing the waters in terms of its policies to try to do that, to make this shift, which is a big structural shift, a long-term shift, but it's in the process of trying to do that. And the shift means a slowing of economic growth. All right. At the same time, China has been trying to tame its shadow banking sector that is stimulating, overstimulating, causing bubbles in the construction markets. When it tries to tame the shadow banks, it restricts credit, right? Pulls some credit out, money out of the construction sector. Well, that's not an efficient way to tame the shadow banks because it slows down the rest of the economy. What we have in China is this convergence of the convergence to consumption and the effort to tame the shadow banks. And throughout last year, that's what China tried to do. In the spring, it restricted credit, caused a credit crunch, and slowed down the economy. Last June. Oh, they, policymakers in China, quickly retreated and say, well, wait a minute. We got to have economic growth. Let's go back to the policies. And they introduced a mini-stimulus focused, again, on infrastructure, primarily on building fast trains and the railroad system, modern railroad system throughout China. So a mini-stimulus was the reaction to the contraction. But then they turned once again and attempted to go after the shadow banks, contract again the credit to the shadow banks to, you know, stop this bubble in the construction housing sector. And the same thing happened. So China, since last spring, is on this stop-go, trying to make it a long-term transition to consumption, trying to tame the shadow banks. Every time it does it, the economy slows a little bit. And they respond to try to get the economy going again. That's the picture in China. And that's why China is slowing down to about 7% GDP official, probably somewhere between 5 and 6 unofficial this year. Now, when China slows down like that, when this economy slows down, its demand for emerging market commodities and resources and natural resources, intermediate goods, and so forth, you know, Australia, minerals and so forth, all that slows down too. The demand for that, China slows down, the demand for that slows down. And, of course, when the slowing occurs, this China and Asia and emerging market stock markets react as well to the negative news. And then China goes and pumps up the economy. Demand for commodities rises a little bit, and, whoop, you know, everyone goes back. Okay, so we're bouncing up and down here, but the long-term trend is a gradual slowing in China, which has a drag on the emerging markets. Now, enter the Federal Reserve that has been pumping all this money into the global economy and Bank of England, etc. And about the same time, coincidentally, almost about the same time, last spring 2013, the Federal Reserve says we're going to probably slow down this QE. In other words, pumping $85 billion a month into the hands of bankers and speculators and ultra-high net worth folks who then take the money and push it out into financial markets and elsewhere in the world. Right? We're going to slow that down. Whoa, looked like the game, you know, the free money game, might be coming to an end, and the financial markets reacted negatively. Stock markets took a sharp dive in the West, and you know, interest rates started rising a whole point. By the way, that rise in the interest rates gets reflected in mortgage rates and provided a real negative shock to the housing market in the U.S. that was trying to recover. Interest rates spiked up 1% and pretty much caused that whole market to stop dead in its tracks, the housing recovery. And ever since then, it's been struggling. Okay, so the Fed announces, didn't even do it, just announces QE was going to maybe be slowed. And we get a, In other words, that policy is called the taper. We're going to taper QE, reduce it, baby. Right? And the emerging markets and stock markets around the world have a temper tantrum, or maybe you should call it a taper tantrum, as some have. Well, the Fed backs off immediately in the summer and says, no, we didn't mean that, you know, and it undertakes some policy in statements and actions, and, oh, we're not going to taper, and the markets go back up. Okay, so every time you have this stop-go on the taper, the emerging markets have indigestion. And then the Fed does it again and gives an announcement in September it may do that. Whoop, we have another reaction in stock markets and financial markets, and especially in emerging economies. But then the Fed backs off again because U.S. government is mired in a government shutdown and a debt ceiling deal, October fiasco. And the Fed doesn't want to exacerbate it. And the Fed is about to transition from Ben Bernanke's chairman to another one, Janet Yellen, now as well. So the Fed backs off a second time. Everything restabilizes. But then the Fed, after the debt ceiling shutdown deal is resolved, excuse me, actually does start the taper in December of last year. Well, that really gives a signal to emerging markets that this is for real. And the money starts flowing out of emerging markets back to the U.S., as I said, back to Europe. It flows into Europe in particular, especially into the U.K. Right? A lot of Asian money flows back into the U.K. The U.K. has a lot of Asian contacts. And it flows into London and South England real estate. So we get a housing commercial property bubble in London and South England. Prices, start escalating further, but it boosts GDP a little bit. At the same time, the Chinese decide they're not going to buy as much U.S. bonds, so they start investing in real property and real projects around the world even more, and that includes construction projects in England as well. In other words, Prime Minister Cameron has got running around the world with a hat in his hand saying, give us some money, give us some money. And the investment is flowing out of the emerging markets. It's got to go somewhere. The rich people don't sit on their money. So it's going into Europe, UK, and other places. Some of it's coming back into the U.S. Multinational companies are moving money back into the U.S. Some of it, a little of it, is going into Japan. So the scenario is one of China slowing down for those two reasons we gave, slowing down emerging markets, and then the Federal Reserve, followed quickly by the Bank of England and others, saying we're going to reduce the taper. We're going to taper. We're going to reduce QE, and it's going to continue doing that throughout the year in small steps. So the markets don't get too, stock markets don't get too much indigestion in the whole process. But that means the money's all coming back to the West. At the same time, Japan parrots the U.S. last year with its announcement of its massive QE program as well. Even more than the U.S., it's $68 billion a month in QE. By the Bank of Japan, doing the same thing the U.S. did. After all, Japan has had a triple dip since 2008, and they're desperate. No real fiscal stimulus. In fact, contractionary fiscal policy coming with a tax hike. But massive injection of central bank money in Japan. Oh, not surprisingly, there goes the Japanese stock market. For the first 9 months, big increases, 70-80% increase in the stock market. But then the stock market slows down. So now Japan is injecting even more money. just announced yesterday. Well, that's exactly what the Federal Reserve did. You know, we've had three versions of QE. Each time the stock market goes up, when it looks like QE is running out, oh, it goes down. Then another announcement of QE2, up it goes, levels off, up it goes again, QE3. Japan's doing the same thing. But the same thing is happening in Japan. It's not really stimulating the real economy. Only 1% GDP growth here in the fourth quarter. That's not much of a stimulus. And now it looks like it's slowing even further. You know, monetary policy does not stimulate the real economy. It stimulates financial markets. But the bankers and wealthy folks, ultra-high net worth individuals, they love that. That's what they want. That's recovery for them, even if it's not for us. So we have this scenario of monetary policy, QEs, and massive liquidity injections, you know, stimulating financial markets and wealthy recovery, you know, but not doing much for the rest. And when that reverses, all the money where it once went comes flowing back. That's what's happening. This is why we're in a third stage, third phase beginning to occur, because the money is flowing back from emerging markets, some of it from China, but mostly the emerging markets back to Europe, back to the U.S., and Japan is now just starting what its round of what the U.S. and Europe did 3 years ago. Okay, so three interesting things happened last year. China, for two reasons, began to slow, try to tame its shadow banking system, try to make a convergence to real consumption-based growth. At the same time, last spring, the Federal Reserve announces its long-term policy of reducing QE and money injections. At the same time, Japan jumps into money injections and QE. All of that occurring spring of last year, and now we're beginning to see those three policies affect each other. But the biggest effect is the capital flight out of the emerging markets that has started last year and is accelerating now. Why is money being brought out? Because it's coming back to the West, and that means a capital flight. That means collapse of currencies in emerging markets, and you have collapsing currencies. Investors have another reason for not investing. Who wants to put their money in an economy where you have to buy Brazilian real when Brazilian currency is going to fall the next day and you got less value for what you bought? Well, then, another reason. Money flows out rather than flows in. The emerging markets then try to stop the process by raising their interest rates. That slows their real economy even further. They then turn around and take it out on their working class by cutting wages and services and benefits. That's called austerity. And it slows things down even further. Now we're in a vicious down cycle in emerging economies, just as we were in the West. We've exported the crisis, in other words. Western policies are exporting the crisis once again to another part of the world. And that's the picture. Now, as the emerging markets slow down, they buy fewer exports from Europe and the U.S. You know, Germany has barely kept its head above water in Europe, but that's because massive export, half of their economy is export-oriented, and most of that goes to China and emerging markets, believe it or not. So as that all slows down, the engine in Europe, Germany, exports, and their economy will slow down to some extent as well, and that means the rest of Europe, depending on Germany, is going to slow down. Okay, that's the picture, the contagion through the export linkage between these sectors and the money linkages between these sectors. They are converging, and we are getting negative mutual amplifying effects. And we will see to what extent this has a further impact on the U.S. economy here in 2014 as well, because we are not isolated from the rest of the global economy. In other words, you cannot look at this crisis unless you look at it globally. You cannot simply look at the U.S. and what's happening in the U.S. It's a global system capitalism. It's a global process, and the global sectors are interacting with each other in different ways. And what I'm suggesting is this interaction may be shifting us from a global growth in emerging markets in the rest of the world and stagnation in the West to a stagnation decline in emerging markets and a slowing in the West. Okay, this is Jack Rasmus. That's a mouthful. We'll be talking next week about similar topics.